The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem, Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, good afternoon and greetings. Thank you for being with us, the Wednesday edition of The Ride Home. First full day of spring. It's the 20th of March.
Cold.
Chilly.
Cold, cold, cold. Wore another flannel today.
I'm wearing a flannel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And a scarf. I dug my scarf out yesterday.
Sure.
And I decided that I'm just going to keep it out until further notice.
How's it look next week?
Any idea? I have not looked.
Neither have I.
Mm-mm.
All right. But
I'm going to the spring flower show at Phipps this weekend.
Are you?
Yes. So, I mean, I go with my best friends from high school every year.
Yep.
And more than once it's been snowing
mm-hmm.
when we've done it.
It's still early.
We're fine.
This morning I watched Major League Baseball in South Korea. First game of the season. First real game of the season. The Dodgers and the Padres, they've got a short series. So spring is here.
What, is this like a promotional thing?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay.
They do this, you know, they travel around the globe. So South Korea, Ohtani, I saw Ohtani play.
Let me guess, he looked good.
He looked fabulous. Mm-hmm. He did, yeah.
The Dodgers, that's not fair. Okay. That's like RoboCop
yeah.
baseball.
It's a billion-dollar payroll.
That's not even right.
Meanwhile, the Pirates have got $180.
That's all right. I have a lot
Me
of excitement
too.
In
I'm
my
super
heart
excited.
For the Pirates this year.
Me too.
Okay?
We may be fools, right? We may
yeah,
be saying,
but, I, oh, but I'm still excited
I'm
about it.
I'm super pumped.
Coming up in the 5 o'clock hour of today's Ride Home,
yeah.
we've got an interesting conversation coming up at 5:10 about female heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're a guy, you might think, well, this is dumb. What do women need heroes for?
Everybody needs a hero.
But I have a lot. Most of my heroes are men, but I want to have female heroes.
Of course. What?
I wanna,
is that a thing? Why is that a thing?
Oh, because I know a lot. I've known a lot of men in my life who feel like,
what?
Well, that's just silly.
Sorry.
Okay. All right, we'll talk just about saying. That. Also, the feature, Does This Make Sense? And at the 5 o'clock hour, 5 at 5.
Oh, the 5.
5 of 5 was supposed to be done yesterday, and 3 out of 3 of us forgot.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
So we're doing it today.
Very nice.
Also, in this hour, John, stores and restaurants are offering paid memberships.
What do you mean, like Costco?
Yeah.
They're offering.
Kind of like what some physicians have done with like concierge service, where they're not going to take insurance. They're just going, you pay them.
Privately,
and they're going to be your doctor.
Okay, great.
So now you can do the same thing maybe with a restaurant.
You mean another way to spend money?
Exactly.
Okay, good.
I've been spending so much money lately.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just, I went to the grocery store yesterday and I thought,
We have a daughter who's getting married.
Yeah,
that's part of the mix as well.
That is what it's.
Of course it is.
I can't believe how much money I'm
just
spending.
Saying.
Anyway, happy to have you along for today's ride home.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right.
Glad
so without
you're
further
here,
ado,
yeah, I was talking to the listening audience, but fine.
All right. Here's the news stories of the day, the top 4 at 4.
For Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, let's start with some happy news. Happy birthday to our good friend Eddie Jones.
Eddie. Very nice, Eddie.
We love Eddie so much.
Excellent human
and
being.
And speaking of people that we love so much, also, happy birthday to Mike Adams.
Mike Adams.
Today's his birthday, too.
Fabulous.
Can you believe that?
Two excellent people on the same day.
Listen, if Mike Adams wasn't here, Word FM would collapse in upon itself.
Fall off the rails.
Absolutely.
If he's on here for 15 minutes,
listen,
he falls off the
I'm
rails.
Telling you, he
Seriously.
Keeps the whole place together.
He does. So
happy
cheers
birthday
to, you, Mike.
To Eddie and Mike.
Eddie.
All right, now to the news. Number one, Marwan Issa, behind-the-scenes orchestrator of Hamas operations and the number 3 official in Hamas's Gaza hierarchy, was killed in an Israeli airstrike. One of the key military objectives for Israel has been the elimination of top-tier Hamas leaders responsible for the October 7th attack on Israel, which was, as we all know, the worst in the nation's history. According to today's Wall Street Journal, this action, quote, contributes to the continuous degradation of Hamas's capabilities as a cohesive fighting force, and also their ability to coordinate operations against Israeli forces in Gaza in the short to medium term. Read more about that at today's Wall Street Journal. Number two, the U.S. State Department says it's exploring options to evacuate American citizens trapped in Haiti, where things just continue to go from bad to worse, John.
How can you still be there?
I can't. 10 U.S. nationals arrived in Florida yesterday aboard a private plane that was chartered by missionaries out of Haiti. Many others are still hoping to escape. They're worrying about those they've left behind. 15,000 people have been made homeless in Haiti just in the last 2 months. As many waited for an opportunity to get out of the island country, a missionary flight from Fort Pierce, Florida, landed in Cap Haitien, carrying roughly 5,300 pounds of critical humanitarian supplies, including food and baby formula. Read more detail at today's CBS News. Number three. Former Rankin County, Mississippi Sheriff's Deputies Hunter Elward and Jeffrey Middleton were sentenced in federal court after pleading guilty, along with five additional former law enforcement officers, to a total of 16 charges related to the January 2023 torture of two black men. Elward, who pleaded guilty to the most serious charge in the indictment, was sentenced to about 20 years in prison. This is what he said in court. "I hate myself for it." He said, "I accept my responsibility." Middleton was sentenced to 17 and a half years for his role. The remaining four officers who pleaded guilty will be sentenced during hearings Wednesday and Thursday. Eddie Parker, the second victim in the case, told Elward in court yesterday that he forgave him for his actions and said he is, quote, satisfied with the sentence. Read more about that. Oh, let me also say, I guess I forgot this last part. The convicted officers were from a group, John, who called themselves the Goon Squad because of, quote, their willingness to use excessive force and not report it, according to the documents. Again, from ABC News. And number four. Many area doctors, John, have noticed the spring allergy season has appeared a little before schedule. They're crediting a mild winter as the main culprit of your allergic distress. And that's your top four at four.
You have allergies?
I didn't used to, and now I kind of do.
Really?
They were bothering me last night.
Like what? Sniffles?
Yeah.
Sneezes?
I was very stuffed up.
Allergic to?
I don't know.
Something.
I don't know. The National Weather Service says this winter has been the warmest on record for the region since 1952.
Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh. March is on track to be the second warmest in 70 years. Doctors also said in the article that if you're allergic to tree pollen, that because of the way the weather's changed, that you can have kind of an overlap with perhaps a mold allergy you have, or perhaps a dander allergy you have, or whatever. And so everything kind of bleeds one into the other. So it's not just, wow, we're in allergy season. Like, you might be allergic to several things and you're experiencing grief all at the same time.
All right. Well, that's,
do you have allergies?
No.
Okay. Lex, do you have allergies?
Food allergies, but not regular allergies.
Okay. All right. Well, a lot of people do, so look out.
Mm-hmm. It's a pick-me-up. Mm-hmm. It's National French Bread Day.
Is it?
Just wanted to say that.
I didn't know.
Keep your eye on the French bread.
Man, you know what? You know where I'd love to eat French bread? In France.
Yeah. Yeah, in a French bakery.
Yep. That's where I'd like to eat it. So if you could arrange that for me, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, with a tub of butter.
Yep.
We'll take a quick break. Come back. Liddy Barlow is with us. She's amazing. Christian Associates is a ministry right here locally in Pittsburgh that she heads. We'll talk about that Christian Associates next on The Ride Home. Liddy Barlow is back with us. She is the executive director of the Christian Associates. Liddy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back. It's great to hear both of you.
Liddy, I hear that you're celebrating 10 years in your role at Christian Associates, which is hard to believe. I remember when you first started in that role. I remember where we met.
Yeah, it is amazing that it has been a whole decade since I started back in the spring of 2014. And now here we are 10 years later. It's amazing. I feel so thankful to have been part of this ministry as long as I have.
For Liddy, for the uninitiated, talk to us about what Christian Associates is and the work that you do.
Absolutely. So Christian Associates is our region's Christian unity organization. We bring together Christians who are Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox, Black and white, progressive and conservative, urban and rural, to build real relationships with each other and to help make visible the unity of the church in our area.
Excellent.
We also do a lot to build bridges between the church and our civic community and interfaith partners.
So, Liddy, you know, there are so many things that we could talk to you about, but I think I want to start with just an overview on your behalf. I mean, you have a unique position in Pittsburgh where you get to see so much of what God's doing in different parts of the city and also different theological families in the city and denominational perspectives. Can you talk about some of the stuff that you've seen over the last decade, maybe some of the trends you've seen, some of the things that are remarkable to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have made real progress in our quest for visible unity over these last 10 years. You know, when I started, we were really fresh off of some of the very painful schisms that had happened in some of our church bodies in recent times, both the Episcopal and Anglican split, as well as, you know, similar struggles that the Presbyterians and Lutheran churches experienced. And of course, our Methodist brothers and sisters are enduring that now. But I have some hope because I have seen signs of healing and reconciliation, of moving beyond those bitter divisions into something new. And that has been really wonderful to see. I'm also seeing a lot of signs of increased connection between our mainline denominational churches and our non-denominational and evangelical churches, that we're breaking down some of those boundaries of mistrust and misunderstanding between us. And that feels really encouraging as well.
That's so good. I mean, I really applaud the efforts that you make, Liddy, because it seems there's a huge difference, of course, always when people sit down in the same room. They're not on Zoom. They're not on a phone call. And they look each other in the eye and they share their stories. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I convene the bishops and executives of our member church bodies 4 times a year. And we met a couple weeks ago at a Presbyterian church in Canonsburg for our quarterly meeting. And I was a little worried before the meeting because I wasn't sure that I had enough on the agenda to make these important church leaders feel like they had, you know, that it was a good use of their time to come to this meeting. What I had prepared for them was simply an opportunity for them to have some one-on-one conversations with each other. We set up the room kind of like one of those speed dating events where, you know, there's two circles and one circle stays in their chair and the other one rotates. And we had some questions for them to discuss. And we spent an hour sitting in these circles having one-on-one conversations. And I couldn't get them to stop talking. You know, every time we were at the end of a question, I had to practically jump up and down and be like, all right, it's time to move on. They, you know, given the opportunity, people are so hungry to connect across our differences.
Fabulous. Wow.
That makes me so glad, Liddy, because everything we see online is terrible.
Divisive.
The acrimony is palpable. It's so unhealthy to go and see, like, even watch, you know, 3 different exchanges on Twitter because you feel like dirtier afterward. It's just everybody is angry and everybody, to me, seems so certain of their rightness.
But if Jesus is in the middle of all that we say
right,
and do,
then we have to act
the great unifier.
Right. We have to act differently than that. So you're telling me that in person, it's just a different world than the stuff we see online?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree. Like, I see the same thing in my social media, right? I think it's very easy to be really rude and dismissive and insistent on our own way when we're in those online spaces. You know, and so I think we have to, you know, touch grass, like they say, right? We have to remind ourselves that there really is a world outside of our screens. And I think we can also, at our best, bring some of that same sense to our online interactions. Hmm. You know, one of the most interesting online interactions I ever saw, a friend of mine had, you know, posted something on Facebook about a controversial issue, and people were going at each other in the comments on her post. And what she did that I thought was so interesting is instead of interjecting more of her thoughts on that issue, she introduced the people who were commenting on it to each other. Like, hey, John, Joan was my second grade teacher. I really loved the unit we did on caterpillars.
Oh, that's cool.
Hey, Joan, John is my uncle, and we used to fly kites together in the backyard. Right? Like, we are all more than our opinions. We are all whole people, and we are all children of God. And I think, you know, whatever it takes to remind ourselves of that can be really helpful.
I'm into that. Lady Barlow's with us. She's the executive director of Christian Associates here in Western Pennsylvania. Lady, you gave us a sort of a rundown of all the things you've been doing recently. And one of the big things that caught my eye was that you participated in a Pittsburgh Leadership Foundation Senior Leaders Collaborative last week. And you talk about one of the exercises that you did, that you named your top 10 values. And then you went home and you shared that. You said to your husband, let me see your top 10 values. And then your child did the same thing as well. You were all closely connected within those 10 values. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I loved the opportunity to participate in the Senior Leaders Collaborative. We've been collaborating more and more with Pittsburgh Leadership Foundation and the Reverend Dr. Lee Kreicher and the amazing work that he does, the strong legacy of that organization over so many decades in Pittsburgh. And so this spring, I finally, my calendar aligned for me to participate in this collaborative. And my favorite part of our first day together at the collaborative was an exercise where we had 50 different cards with a different value printed on each card. So, you know, generosity, honesty, open-mindedness, values like that. And you had to sort them into piles. What are your top 10? Which ones are also important? Which ones are less important to you? And it's hard. They're all good things. So eventually I came up with my 10, and I was fascinated to bring this home and make my family do it. So I gave it to my husband.
Cool.
He went through the cards, and it was interesting because his top 10 only had one card that was the same as the values that I had chosen.
Oh.
So that was interesting. And then we gave it to my daughter, who is almost 14, and she sorted through the cards, and she picked her top 10, and it only included two cards that didn't appear either on my list or on my husband's. It turns out that she had developed her key values as a combination of both of ours, and I thought, wow, it's really a relief to see my kid is actually learning something from her parents.
Isn't that awesome? That is such a great exercise. And does it help you maybe to understand yourself if you think about your parents doing that exercise?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to think about which of these values that are so important to me come directly from my parents. I think about a value like humor, which wound up in my top 10. And I'm just thinking about my dad and the way that he kind of went through life, really looking for the joy and the fun in situations, and the way he loved to play with words and loved bad puns. And I see that so much in myself. And then I think some of my other values, I think, got formed by the circumstances of my life, you know, that some comes from your family and then other things come through. You know, I think of my daughter, a child of the pandemic. You know, one of the values that she named that was not on my husband's and my list was adaptability. And I just think how important that has been
in her life
so far.
No kidding. You know, that adaptability, I remember my husband and I sitting down with our girls who were both at home during the pandemic, and saying to them, the number one skill that you are going to cultivate is being flexible. And I promise you, in whatever line of work you have, this will work to your benefit.
Always.
You know, so it's not like you're just here treading water. This is really a life skill if you take advantage of it, right? And so your daughter felt the same way.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I think it's just been so much of our lives, you know, over that, you know, 2020, 2021, 2022, even like period, where we learned to be flexible, where we learned to you know, kind of there's that old cliche, you know, we plan, God laughs, right? Like that sense right. that like, you know, all of our plans we have to hold lightly because, the you know, things can change. And I think being flexible and adaptable in the midst of that change is a real gift.
Amen. Lady Barlow's with us. He's the executive director of ministry here in the city of Pittsburgh, Christian Associates. Lady, in our final few minutes, next week, of course, is Holy Week. And this is one of the seminal week of the Christian walk. Talk about, as we're ending Lent and into Holy Week, what does that mean for you? And, of course, well, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse of what's happening in Christendom across Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I love the rhythms of Holy Week, and I love experiencing those in the company of the churches that we serve. You know, there are a few flagship ecumenical events that happen in the city during Holy Week, especially on Good Friday. There's that ecumenical service of Tenebrae at St. Paul Cathedral in Oakland that includes leadership from a wide variety of denominational traditions participating in that service, and particularly the just stunning singing of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Pia Jesu in the dim cathedral has really become a experience of Holy Week that I cherish. Then we get up on Saturday morning and we get to bless the city. You know, all the religious leaders gathered in front of St. Mary of Church up on Mount Washington, sprinkling water on the city, offering our Easter blessings. And that has become a wonderful way to begin Easter celebration.
Wow. I think without the immersion into the sadness of Holy Week, the rejoicing of Easter has to be lessened.
Yeah, I think we have to enter into the whole story. And what I love about the story of Holy Week is that it is such a human story. You know, Jesus isn't working a lot of, you know, big supernatural miracles on the days of Holy Week. You know, this is a story about a man and his friends going through this extraordinary, painful but poignant experience together, you know, gathering for those precious last minutes together around the table on Maundy Thursday, you know, washing the disciples' feet. It's a celebration of the best of what makes us human. Mm-hmm. And I think being part of the pain and the poignancy, it really does accentuate our Easter celebration.
Fabulous. Lydia, both Kath and I are fans of the work that you do. Mm-hmm. You're so excellent out in Western Pennsylvania with Christian Associates. Take a moment and talk to our audience about Christian Associates and where they can see more.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can be found online at CASP.org. That's CASP for Christian Associates Southwest Pennsylvania.org. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Christian Associates SWPA. And hey, join us on April 11th for the little party we're throwing for my 10th anniversary. More at CASP.org/10 years written out as two words.
Congratulations to you, Liddy. We're grateful for you.
Fabulous.
Hey, absolutely. Thank you both so much, and thank you for the ministry that you do. It's great talking with you.
That's Lady Barlow, Executive Minister of Christian Associates of Southwestern PA.
This is a really wild story. Researchers have discovered 10 shipwrecks, including one estimated to be more than 5,000 years old off the coast of Greece, along with scattered ancient artifacts from around the globe. Listen, using Homer's Iliad as a guide, an underwater archaeological team...
Wait. What does that mean?
Well, did you read Iliad?
Yeah, I read it.
In high school?
Yeah, I don't remember anything about it.
Well, there's a journey that takes place, right? So
right, and...
It's high school. So I have no deeper understanding of using Homer's Iliad as an archaeological guide.
Right, and I don't remember that there were actual geographical
markers.
Right.
Well,
apparently there were.
Because using Homer's Iliad
That's incredible.
As a guide, an underwater archaeological team made the discoveries during a 4-year survey off the coast of Kasos, a small island in the Aegean Sea, the Greek Ministry of Culture announced today. During the underwater missions, teams found the remains of 10 doomed vessels spanning thousands of years of history, the oldest one dating back to 3000 BC.
What?
The ship sank during different eras, including the classical period, the Hellenistic period, the Roman years, the Byzantine period. The team also found the remains of a more recent vessel, a World War II era ship made of wood that was also more than 100 feet long. And near the wrecks, the ministry said researchers discovered a trove of, quote, unique finds originating from Spain, Italy, Africa, and Asia Minor, including a Spanish amphora with a seal on its handle dating between 150 and 170 A.D. Also discovered were drinking vessels, flasks from Africa, a stone anchor from the Archaic period, which lasted from the 8th century until the 5th century. I mean,
how did a boat from 3000 B.C. survive? That's outrageous.
And usually when you read these stories, you think, well, it survived because the water was cold and it was so deep. But here in Greece, you think cold water.
Yeah, it's
and
Mediterranean,
they were not
right?
found that deep. I mean, they were only all the wrecks were between 65 and 155 feet below. I mean, that's deep.
Yeah,
but still,
but right.
It's not like the Titanic or something like that. Anyway, super cool. I'm sure we'll hear much more about this.
I can't wait to hear more about that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Excellent.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, conversation continues. The least religious cities in America. We talked about that last week. Seattle topped the list, as I remember. We'll talk about what that means and perhaps how connected it is to the loss of institutional trust. That's next in The Ride Home. Thanks for being here.
Dr. Ryan Berg is back with us. Ryan is the Assistant Professor of Political Science at Eastern Illinois University, author of two separate works, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America, and The Nuns, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They Are Going. But today, Ryan is with us to talk to us about the loss of institutional confidence, our confidence lost, and most importantly, the least religious cities in the country. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, Ryan, we talked about we named at least the least religious cities in America after I saw that news story come out last week. I believe that Seattle was at the top of the list of least religious. Am I right about that?
Yeah, Seattle and San Francisco are pretty darn close in terms of the least religious attendance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So no surprise.
Yeah, that wasn't a surprise. One of the cities that I was surprised was included was Chicago, simply because I feel like, you know, historically there's been such a heavy Eastern European influence there. I would think it was heavily Catholic. Do you know any of the changes that have contributed to what's happened in Chicago?
So a little bit of Chicago is the fact that those ethnic neighborhoods still exist, but Chicago's kind of been taken over by people moving into the city from other places inside the United States. You know, I grew up downstate Illinois, and I have lots of friends that live in Chicago and the surrounding areas for jobs. You know, they commute to the city and work there. So I think, you know, the economy changing the way it is, these ethnic neighborhoods don't have as much – people are moving more, right? They're finding work in different places. And I think that's changing, you know, the composition of a lot of these major metropolitan areas. There's just so much volatility in those places, people moving in, people moving out, and that changes the religious composition.
Yeah. So, Ryan, do you have a top 10 list of the least religious cities?
Yeah, so San Francisco, Seattle, Boston, which is really interesting given the Catholic heritage of Boston. Philly is next, which is also interesting too. L.A., which is interesting given the Hispanic population, you know, in Southern California.
Yeah.
So D.C., New York, Phoenix, Chicago, and Detroit. And then the most of the 15 metro areas I looked at, which are the largest 15 metro areas in the United States, the most religious are Dallas, Houston, Atlanta. Which I think we all can, you know, find the common denominator between those three places, the South, especially Texas. Texas is still a relatively religious place. And also, I think the key to those couple places is, you know, population density is relatively low in those metro areas. So they're urban, but not like New York City urban, right? Or Chicago urban. People are more spread out across the metroplex. And I think that tends to lead to a different kind of religiosity than sort of a more densely packed urban core.
Okay. So how does the denseness of population contribute? Like what would be different religion or, you know, daily religious life wise?
It's really hard to run a church in an urban area. If you really think about the logistical challenges of just something so basic as rent, You know, rent's really expensive in a downtown area, especially a densely packed downtown area. Are you going to rent out part of a skyscraper, you know, a store? Like, what are you going to do there? There's just not space to have. Parking. What are you going to do about parking downtown if people are going to, you know? So basically what would have to happen is you would have to have people who live in the neighborhood. You'd have neighborhood churches, which is really not a thing anymore. People go to church. They will drive past 10 churches to go to the church they like.
Sure.
So imagine you live in a neighborhood and your closest church you don't like, but the next church you do like is 12 or 14 or 16 blocks away. That's an Uber ride or a Metro ride, and that's expensive. So I think logistically it's just very challenging to run a church in a major metropolitan area.
Hmm. Ryan Burge is with us. We're talking about the least and the most religious cities in the country. Ryan, my wife and I went and saw Dune 2 last night at an IMAX theater. And I had not read the book. I'd seen the first Dune. But this second movie, I can't tell you how deeply, you know, a Hollywood spirituality is all over this movie. I mean, there is so much God talk and so much genuflection and all these sort of different things from a secular world perspective, which makes me think, and of course you've written deeply about this, you wrote a book about it, that people still, even less religious, but still spiritual or leaning towards spiritual, yeah?
I think that's, I mean, that's, people ask you, okay, so what's the good news? Well, the bad news is that, you know, 30% of Americans are nuns, and the share of Americans who never attend religious services is north of 40% now. The good news is this, though. If you ask people what they believe about God, only about 10% of people say that God doesn't exist or we can't know if God exists or not. So atheist agnostic worldview is only about 10% of Americans. So even a lot of people who never – so if you look at people who never attend religious services and you ask them what they believe about God, they're just as likely to say that God exists without any doubts as they are to say that God doesn't exist at all, about 25% in each of those two categories. So spirituality and religion is always going to be part, at least in my lifetime, it's always going to be part of the American religious landscape. It's the other parts, especially the behavior part, the going to church part, that's fallen away. The belief is very stubborn. I think it's deeply rooted in the American psyche, and I don't see any evidence it's going away anytime soon.
But what does that what's the effect of that? What's downstream of this continued belief in God but lack of practice? Do you have any ideas?
Yeah. So the one thing that I'm really, really concerned about is religion has become almost a cultural marker as opposed to like a thing you do. It's a thing you are. So like I'm Catholic or I'm Protestant, or I'm evangelical, right? So you identify with that thing based on the tribal marker and what it means politically and socially, and you don't go to church. You know, that's the interesting thing. We're seeing the rise of the non-attending evangelical Christian. If you look at the data, the best part about religion from a social science perspective is the going to church part. It teaches you all kinds of good things like civic skills and tolerance and deliberation and political activity and all these things. People are not doing the best part of religion. They're actually doing the worst part of religion, which is the belonging piece, the us versus them, that I'm right and you're wrong and I can't see the other side of the argument piece. So I really think religion has been reduced to sort of its worst form. And that's why people are leaving so rapidly, because like, well, if that's what religion is, I don't want anything to do with that.
Right. So what about the intersection then, Ryan, the loss of religious faith and the rise or the coupling with the lowering of institutional trust in this country, right? I mean, to me, I get my haircut from an old Italian barber in my neighborhood, and he's always got the TV set on. Every story that comes on, he'll watch the news. Every news story comes on, he sits there and mutters and goes, it's all a fix. It's all a fix. I mean, everything is a fix today. Everybody believes that, you know, everything's rigged. So we have nothing that's, you know, powerful or truthful God in this country to sort of hang ourselves, our hats on, is this is the ultimate. The truth is here.
Yeah, that's the decline in institutional trust might be the most depressing thing that I see in the data. I mean, people are trusting every institution less in American life, whether it be banks or unions or big business or the media or the president or Congress. I mean, the medical industry, the military is the only thing that people have more trust in now than they did 30 years ago.
Really?
Except, interestingly enough, except among millennials. Millennials have gone the other direction when it comes to trust in the military. Probably because of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, this is a real problem for us as a society. We're a society based on institutions, and more people seem more and more distrustful of everything around them, including their fellow man. And it's really hard to work in a functioning democracy when no one trusts anyone or anything. Yeah. And I think that's what we're spiraling to right now. And unfortunately, I don't think religious leaders think about that enough and preach about that enough. There's value in institution. And if you want to see why denominations are collapsing, I think it's because they're part of this larger institutional distrust, yeah, you know, going on in American society.
Right. And I think, you know, we don't have to talk long before we come up with 10 different reasons why people have lost faith in institutions. So it didn't happen accidentally. You know, institutions in many instances just use their capital to wicked,
poorly.
Yeah, poorly and to wicked means and for wicked results. So, so that is what it is. But, you know, my husband and I just finished watching Masters of the Air, which is about a bomber unit in World War II that Steven Spielberg produced for Apple. And it's so excellent. But one of the things that my husband and I keep coming back to at the end of all 9 episodes is, how did 19-year-olds decide to do that? Like, there had to be a lot of confidence in so many things for them to go over there knowing. When they left to be part of this bomber group, the commanding officer said, look to the guy on your left, look to the guy on your right. Only one of you is going to come home. Mm-hmm. So get that in your head.
Yeah.
So they knew that they were going there to die, most of them. What? That has to be a lot of faith in an institution.
I think, you know, what part of it is, though, Kathy, I think it's the media used to cover things differently than they cover it now. You know, I think we all know that FDR was in a wheelchair for entire presidency. He had polio. And one of the complications was he couldn't walk very well. But the media never took pictures of him in a wheelchair. John F. Kennedy had multiple affairs when he was in the White House, as far as we know. And it was never covered in the media. Although a lot of reporters knew it was happening, they didn't talk about it. So I think, you know, it's part of a double-edged sword, right? The media has become more honest and more willing to cover scandal. But I think the problem is they know now that scandal is what leads. And so, you know, the media doesn't report on the planes that land on time.
Mm-hmm.
And they only report on the plane that crashes or slides off the runway or all these bad things that happen. I think when it comes to religion, the only stories you hear about religion in America are this priest molested someone or that pastor stole money from the church or this denomination's having a split over same-sex marriage. You're not hearing about the thousands, literally thousands of churches every day in America who are feeding hungry kids, clothing the naked, visiting the prisoner, and doing good in the community. That doesn't get the headlines, and therefore we only hear the negative. We don't hear the positive, and our trust in these institutions erodes because of that.
Yeah. Ryan Burge is with us. Ryan, you are a numbers and graph guy. In the remaining time here, talk to our audience about your work, what you do, and where they can find you.
Yeah, so I have a Substack, a newsletter called graphsaboutreligion.com, graphsaboutreligion.com. I post on Mondays and Thursdays, free post on Monday, paid post on Thursday, and it's just data, 5 or 6 graphs and about 1,200 words about something I'm seeing interesting in the data. I write about religious leaders. I wrote a post about how much pastors make. I write about what causes churches to grow or decline, what's going on in politics sometimes. I really just try to say, here's what I'm learning by doing this data analysis. Let you know, take a look at this and see what you can learn from this. I've had such great feedback from pastors, denominational leaders, and even non-religious people who want to understand the world around them better. I try to be a neutral referee and just, you know, tell it like it is, not take any sides. And hopefully I feel like that's what we need more and more in society is just an impartial referee as opposed to someone trying to make a point or drive home a political party or a certain candidate. I'm just on the side of truth. And I want you to see the truth as objectively as I possibly can present it to you. And then you can do something. You can respond to that however you want.
Well, man, I appreciate that work.
I appreciate
that attitude. That's Dr. Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. Check out one of his books, including 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America and the Nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, where they came from, who they are, and where they're going. Ryan, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
When I think back to being a kid growing up in the North Hills of Pittsburgh, my parents had a couple memberships. So, are you ready?
Hmm.
So we were members of, my mom and I were members of our church.
Mm-hmm.
And we were members of the pool.
Yep.
The Avonworth Pool, which was not like a country club. It was like a community pool.
Yeah.
And that was it.
2 memberships.
That was it.
We belong to the church. We belong to the Italian club.
Oh, really?
I have no
idea. But you were Irish.
I know. I don't know why. My dad belonged to the American Legion.
Okay.
Of course.
My dad. I forgot. Of course, my dad was a Polish Falcon. What am I forgetting?
Yeah, there you go, right?
I can't believe I didn't think that.
of course, they. I think my mom did a stint with the PTA. Right?
Okay.
Is that about it?
Okay, but so those memberships, that was maybe a yearly fee you paid if you were...
The Italian Club.
At the Italian Club.
Yeah.
It was a monthly thing you would pay at the church.
American Legion.
And at the pool, I'm guessing you paid for the summer.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Right. Like when our kids were growing up, we belonged to our neighborhood pool.
Okay.
Very nice.
There you go. Okay, so now, fast forward.
Yeah.
We're also members of our church.
Yeah.
So that's a monthly thing. We're members of Sam's Club.
Yeah, we belong to Costco.
Okay.
You proud about that?
Not particularly.
Neither do I.
No,
yeah,
I right. don't really care about it. I feel like it's a good deal. I have a couple monthly
subscriptions.
Yes.
A couple.
Yes, I have a couple.
Like
I have cat food.
Oh, really?
Yep. Cat food comes every month. I have paper towels.
Really?
I have some kitchen cleaner.
Is that Amazon?
Yes.
Automatically delivered.
Yes, yeah. Automatically delivered. Or Chewy is the pet mm-hmm. place I go through. Okay. So I have a couple automatic subscriptions. Do you have anything like that
no.
set up?
No.
Okay.
That makes me anxious.
Why?
I don't know. Like all of a sudden, paper towels. I don't know. It just seems like I'll get them when I need them. It feels like a little pressure.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what it is. It is a little pressure.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Okay, well, then you're not the person that restaurants are looking toward because there are restaurant chains that are looking to set up something just like this.
Oh, like Applebee's.
Yep.
Right? Yeah.
What? Does Applebee's have
Applebee's has like a club you can belong
okay.
to. I saw that.
Okay.
Right? The other day there was like, you can get for $200, you can get a thing which is a value of like $1,100 and they sold out like in a minute.
Yeah, okay. Well, at Chuck E. Cheese... Remember, I mean, I spent so much time there when my kids were little.
I hope never to go to Chuck E. Cheese again.
Oh, my gosh. You can get, you can pay $7.99 a month, $11.99 a month, or $29.99 per month. And you can get all sorts of different
perks
mm-hmm. and have access to different things. I'm reading here from the AP. The founder of a shopping app called Long Story Short is charging members $1,000 a month.
What?
For access to really hard to get goods
like
art. Okay. So you're paying for access. So paid loyalty programs apparently are all the rage in the restaurant world and also the retail world. So they're looking for a regular set of income, right?
Who
numbers
is it?
From people like us.
Right.
Right. And so they want to be able to know how much money's coming in and when
sure,
it's coming
sure.
in.
Well, it's like, subscribing to a podcast or
yes,
something
right,
like that.
Right.
You get insider information or extra episodes and things like that.
Yeah. So Target is taking on the Amazon Prime.
We were just
thing.
At Target last night.
Were you? So they've got a paid loyalty program that'll
app.
Cost $49 a year.
They pushed it high.
And $99 annually thereafter.
What am I getting there?
You can expect free 2-day shipping and free deliveries of orders over $35 in as little as an hour.
I don't care.
I don't care either.
I mean, too much stuff. Just too much.
Okay. But Target executives said 100 million customers enrolled in the free Target Circle loyalty plan. They already spend 5 times more than non-members.
Wait, almost a third of the country?
100 million
Get out
people.
Of here.
Now that's not the paid one. That's the free one. Like, do you want to be part of the Target Circle? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you get emails,
app.
Right? You get an app. But those people that do that spend 5 times more at Target than people that don't have that.
The loyal customers.
Right.
I think you get 1% off. That's what,
right.
that's what they were selling us last
okay.
night.
Okay. Well, now that they're trying... So they're thinking, okay, well, obviously we're not going to get 100 million people who are going to say yes to this, but we could get a lot of people mm-hmm. and we could make them even more loyal than they are now.
I see. Okay, so Turner Classic Movies does the wine club.
Really?
Turner Classic Movies I love because there's like no commercials. The only commercials at TCM are like for themselves. And so they've been pushing that wine club forever. You know, you subscribe to the wine club and you get whatever. You get, the Humphrey Bogart wine of the month or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Same kind of thing.
Well, what about people who like luxury goods or like something very niche? Those are the people, I think, that are particularly attracted to someone who could curate that for them.
I guess.
And then maybe for $35 a month, you're going to let somebody tell you what you like.
It just seems like a lot. And it feels like a lot of pressure.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Is it just me, or does this feel like it's been a long week?
Okay, when I pulled into the parking lot today,
yeah.
I thought to myself it was Thursday.
I did too. I thought today was Thursday.
Yeah, so I guess that means yes, it is.
What is that?
It has actually been a long week.
Time is so strange.
Well, I think for me, it just has to do with the fact that it was summer last week, and now it seems like winter again.
It's winter again, yeah.
And I think and it's very overcast.
Right.
Everything just...
We've not seen the sun for a few days, have
no.
we? It was snowing yesterday.
Right. I mean, it's just a lot.
Right. Anyway, for the first time since 2012, America has fallen out of one of the happiest countries in the world. We're falling out of the top 20. We are in 23rd place, down from 15th a year ago. How about that?
So we were 15th a year ago.
And now we're 23.
Okay.
Here's a list of the top 10 list of the happiest countries forward. Australia, number 10. Switzerland, Luxembourg.
Okay, now wait. Let me back up and say, I don't know very much about Australia. But when you're talking about Switzerland, the only people that can live in Switzerland are people. Yeah. Are the people that can. I think you can't move into Switzerland unless you can buy a property mortgage free, like pay cash for it.
All right.
So, I mean, that makes a lot of. Okay, what's next?
Australia, Switzerland, Luxembourg.
Well, I think we know what the average income of Luxembourg is.
Norway.
Okay.
Netherlands.
Israel.
Sweden. Iceland. Denmark. The happiest country in the world.
Finland.
Yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I guessed Finland is the only Nordic country you didn't
Nordic,
mention.
Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, the Netherlands.
What's that about?
I don't know. Maybe blonde hair and blue eyes is a good thing.
Or maybe cold weather is not the bane of existence.
Well,
maybe
by that accounts, we should be like super happy. Yeehaw.
Well, but we haven't had much cold weather is what I'm saying.
So we're kind of middling.
Maybe.
I don't know.
How about Israel being in that list?
Yeah,
I mean,
cool.
Look at what Israel suffers.
Well, this is probably pre-October 7th.
And I know, but forget October 7th.
Yeah.
Prior to October 7th.
Yeah.
Living in Israel is a perilous thing.
Yeah.
It has been for the last 35 years.
So the unhappiness in this list, driven largely by those under 30. And probably, I don't know. There's all these different variables that go with it. Anyway, you want to do our 5 and 5?
Oh, yeah. I'm ready for it, Lex.
Okay. So... Explain how this works.
All right. So we usually do this Tuesday and Thursday.
Yeah.
But yesterday was Tuesday and three out of three of us forgot.
Right.
So basically it's five things. I have my writing implement ready.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to give them to me and I'm going to rank them and give my justifications.
Okay. Here's my 5 at 5 for the day.
Uh-huh.
Grilled cheese.
Okay.
Chicken parm. Reuben. Chipped ham. Peanut butter and jelly.
Oh.
Grilled cheese, chicken parm, Reuben, chipped ham, peanut butter and jelly. The category is?
Five favorite sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, so I'm just doing a little bit of assessment
here.
I'm doing a little bit of assessment. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to make that 5.
All right.
I'm going to do this 4. Okay.
All right. Grilled cheese, chicken parm, Reuben, chipped ham, peanut butter and jelly. Start at number 5, please.
Chicken parm.
What? That's a good sandwich.
I have
what?
No interest in having
what?
Chicken parm on
Are
a sandwich.
Are you kidding me?
Not even a little.
A
it
chicken
doesn't
parm sandwich?
Even sound good to
what's
me.
What's your pizza place in Bloomfield?
Yeah, Pizza Italia. I bet they have a great chicken
they
parm sandwich.
They have a
killer. Do they?
Chicken parm
I
sandwich.
I believe it.
Seriously.
I believe it. Doesn't sound
Number
good
5.
To me.
Doesn't sound good.
No. I mean, chicken parm, okay. On a sandwich, it seems weird. It seems like too much to bear.
It's a slice of heaven is what it is.
It's number 5 for me. Number 4, John, chipped ham.
Now, are you from Pittsburgh?
Now, it's delicious.
It is.
It's delicious. I particularly like it, if you're asking, with Swiss cheese, mayo, and sweet pickle.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's the way it
Everyone's
always was
thing.
When I was growing up. But it is profoundly not good for you. There's nothing about
Doesn't
it
matter.
That's good for you. Mm-hmm. And so I've relegated it to number 4.
All right.
Number 3, John, is the Reuben. Now, because here's the thing. I'm not crazy about a Reuben.
Really?
But I'm very crazy about a Rachel. So instead of the corned beef, you have the turkey.
Yeah.
Instead of the sauerkraut, you have the coleslaw.
Sure.
So I am saying yes to that.
Okay.
Reuben, I would do it, but corned beef isn't my favorite. Okay. But I love the idea,
yeah.
And so it's got a solid number three.
On the marbled rye.
Number two is the grilled cheese. Pardon me.
Really?
Grilled cheese is beautiful.
Classic.
It's nice to look at. It smells good. Mm-hmm. It's easy to make. And the taste, so good.
What are you putting on it?
Thank you for asking. If I had my druthers... Mm. It would be grilled cheese and bacon.
Yeah.
If I did have
sure,
my druthers.
Sure, yeah.
If I was ordering it in a restaurant and somebody else was preparing it, mm-hmm. I would ask for basically grilled cheese, bacon, lettuce, tomato with mayo. And it would be like a club sandwich,
nice.
But hot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm probably not going to do that at home.
No. At home?
No, no, I'm not
going to. Why, too much?
Because that's just too much. I'm not doing all that.
So I don't want... Really?
My latest favorite melty cheese is Krukolo.
What?
You should try that.
Okay, sure.
Number one, John, yeah. Without even a close second, third, fourth, fifth,
I'm shocked.
Is PB&J, the greatest sandwich of all time.
Really?
The only sandwich that would sustain all of us should nuclear apocalypse happen. It is a taste treat. It's easy to make. It's cheap to make. It has protein. It's comforting.
What kind of bread?
You can do anything.
Any bread.
Anything. If I could pick... I would probably do rustic raisin from the breadworks.
Whoa, holy smokes. Raisin bread on a
yes, rustic raisin, open face.
Holy smokes.
So you get peanut butter and sure. jelly on both sides.
And to drink?
Oh my gosh. I would say rich chocolate Ovaltine with ice.
All right.
And some 2% milk.
That's Cass' favorite sandwiches, 5 at 5. We'll take a quick break. We're going to talk about women. And the Bible, the witness of women, is written on the walls. That's straight ahead. Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's the ride home. You're listening to Word FM.
I grew up in the church. I grew up in a Protestant denomination that valued historical leadership. So I grew up learning about, you know, great preachers like Charles Spurgeon or contemporaries like the late John Stott or
John Wesley.
Right. We talked a lot about, we read books by J.I. Packer and R.C. Sproul. Chuck Colson was a huge influence on me when I was in college because I started reading Chuck's books and I was so taught. Schooled is a better word, by how he thought. He had a powerful, powerful intellect.
Chuckles.
Yeah. And I just really, that was so formative for me.
So contemporary men, not so much women.
Whether not as many.
Contemporary or ancient.
Not as many. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's something that's kind of, I don't know, maybe that's a little bit of a deficit of my understanding. Maybe it's a deficit of all of our understandings. But we're happy to have Lanta Davis with us to talk about the article that she wrote for this month's CT called The Witness of Women, written on the walls. Lanta, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi, Lanta. Hey, pleasure that you're with us. The piece at CT, The Witness of Women, is written on the walls. We love this so much. Talk about your upbringing in rural South Dakota, surrounded by farm women.
Yeah, I grew up in a town of 1,000 people and very much grew up kind of with women doing a lot of the work both outside the home and inside the home. So my mom, still just one of the most tough people in general. Like, I mean that even literally, like she could pick up stuff that amazes me that she could pick up. And just always kind of grew up with this understanding that women could do a lot of the, you know, same things. And even last year, I went back to rural South Dakota and learned how to drive a semi. So there's still very
That's
much
awesome.
that idea through it. And I really enjoyed my childhood, very much believed that I could do whatever I wanted to. And I ended up deciding I wanted to teach, to read, to think. I wanted to have some sort of form of leadership in the church. And I wasn't 100% sure yet what that looked like, but I knew I really loved learning. I love books. And I wanted to teach theology. But it was kind of actually in seminary where I first really discovered that there weren't a lot of women I knew who were doing that. Right. And not a lot that I encountered in my theology classes either. It sort of felt like there was a gap. And since I'd grown up kind of, you know, assuming that women were in all these places and I'd seen them in all sorts of different places, it felt like all of a sudden the church just had this gap that I hadn't realized. And it especially seemed to be in writing, like I couldn't find them written about or in the works that I was reading. And that really troubled me. And I wanted some people to point to say, like, look, here's women, you know, teaching, doing the kind of work in theology that I want to be doing. And it took me really, I mean, I found examples here and there, but it was pretty difficult to do. And so eventually when I made a trip to Italy, I just happened upon all of these women on the walls, and it kind of blew my mind because I never had encountered them in the classroom or in my church or really knew anything of their names.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. We're talking to Lanta Davis. Lanta, am I pronouncing that correctly, or is it Lanta?
You are.
Lanta.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Lanta, I want to back up just a little bit before we talk about your trip to Italy.
Yeah.
Because
that's
fine. That's totally fine. It's a good story to tell. But in you talking about your growing up, it reminded me in some ways of my growing up. And we're both so fortunate because my parents basically told me you can do whatever you want to do. Now, that doesn't mean I could like stay out late and, you know, go, you know, drinking
right.
and hanging. Wasn't that. But it was like, if you're looking at your future, as far as your potential, you can do whatever you want to do. So there were no jobs that were like, oh, well, you shouldn't do that because you're a girl, or you shouldn't study that because you're a girl. I didn't have any of that. And as I said, I feel so fortunate about that. But it wasn't until I was in college and I started, or after college, when I read Corrie Ten Boom's book for the first time, that I realized that I didn't have female heroes. And it seems like you thought the same thing at about the same time of your life.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was lucky to find fictional heroes.
Me too. Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice was a huge hero for me.
Yep, exactly. But real historical ones, especially inside the church, it just felt very difficult to pinpoint, to find names, even more than names, because there's some names scattered in scripture, but I didn't know much about them. There wasn't enough for me to imitate, to even gather much other than the most bare, you know, basic details of their lives. And I really wanted something more lived out, something I could kind of understand a little bit better. The way that I had appreciated, you know, so much of like Augustine's life and Paul's, like all the men have these really great different ways, I think, to live the gospel. And it felt like I couldn't find as many just clear cut people that I could point to that were distinctively doing it in a female way too.
But then, Lanta, you say in your piece in CT, The Witness of Women is Written on the Walls, you travel to Italy. And there, for the first time in your life, you discover women heroes and their artistic visions of women, and they're all over the place.
Yeah, it was really shocking, actually, to discover. In part, just because I wasn't used to any art in churches, really, other than the cross, to see art in general. And then also, it's so easy, I think, to internalize ideas of, like, women's bodies as temptations, as evil, as something negative. And so to all of a sudden go there and see, like, women's names written on the churches, their bodies right by the Eucharistic table, to see them physically represented in mosaics, I just sat and stared for a long time, really absorbing what I had never seen before, and what also seemed so obvious, so clear at the same time. It was just very... it just felt miraculous to see what I had always kind of understood Jesus's gospel is saying, which is that we are male and female together, called to follow him. And so it was just very powerful, I think, to finally have a very clear vision, literally, of all of these women doing that.
I love this.
Can you talk about the actual bones of women being yeah. the foundation of churches. For those of us in America, I know this is going to sound like super weird, but this is a European thing. This is a thing in Christian history.
At the Eucharistic altar.
Yep. Yeah. So for a really long time, and I think I still want to say that it's part of the tradition, like in Catholic churches and potentially Russian Orthodox, but the Eucharistic altar actually had to have the bones of a saint, of a martyr in that. It was very much the idea of this is the body of Christ and we are called to become like the body of Christ. And so we too are called to follow these people who very literally took up their crosses and followed Christ to death. And so it's a very eerie, I think, thing, but also really powerful because it helps impress upon us that if we want to participate in the resurrection, we also must participate in Christ's death. And so to go to this table and have, women's bodies, male's bodies, obviously, too, there present, physically built upon them, just reminds you that we are the living stones of the church. We're called to become the walking, living church. And so we have the physical stones of the buildings, but we're also called to, of course, be the presence of church out in the world. And I think having the bones there is a good way of just reminding us of what that call looks like, feels like, and also just what we owe to the people who came before us and who were willing to risk everything to spread the gospel and to hand it down to the next generation.
We're talking to Lanta Davis. She's the author of the forthcoming Becoming by Beholding. She teaches at the John Wesley Honors College at Indiana Wesleyan. I want to go to the 6th century and talk about the Empress Theodora. Can you tell us about her, what she was like, what her story was?
Yeah, so Theodora is fascinating in part because we only kind of get her story through a man writing about her who seemed to have hated her
okay.
a little bit. But even his description just shows how powerfully she stood up for women's rights, how much power she actually had in the Christian Empire in general at this point in time. So a lot of people would have considered her not just a co-ruler with her husband, Justinian, but in fact, kind of the real brains and power and motivation behind it, which means that she was not just ruling like one country, but this was all of Christendom in some ways after Rome has fallen. So she's in Ravenna, and she grew up as an actress, which back in the day also meant that she was probably likely a prostitute as well. So a very unconventional woman to become an empress of the Christian Empire. And once she did marry the emperor, she had actually a child out of wedlock with another man. She had been his mistress for a while. And she remembered how difficult things were for her, how awful it was to essentially have your body be your only means of support. And so she fought for women's rights. She closed brothels. She managed to change a lot of laws. She helped protect women by giving them more rights over their children in case there was some sort of separation with men. And a lot of the laws that she and Justinian instituted are actually the basis for a lot of the women's rights laws that we still have today. So
that's
we
fascinating.
Don't know that much about her. Yeah, but she's really important, actually, in the historical development of women's rights. And she was already in the late 5th century, early 6th century, doing these amazing things.
Fabulous. So, Lanta, this eye-opening journey that you took to Italy, I mean, why don't we know more about this? I mean, you essentially went on some kind of like an archaeological dig and unearthed women who were powerful in the church and in their communities, and they knew about and loved Jesus. There's a peeling back here, and I think here in America especially, we're ignorant of all these women.
Yeah, I thought about this a lot in terms of just the why behind it, because they're amazing and interesting, and there's all these visual, beautiful things that you can look at to see them. But it's always a complicated story. I mean, you can point it in part to, normal patriarchal problems, but I think in part it's how we learn. And especially after the Protestant Reformation, I think there was some skepticism of the role of images, of buildings, of things like that. We went very simple. And I think in the process, we lost some of the connection we had to these women who are depicted in the church spaces, who do have that historical connection to our early church. And that's related in part to a kind of Protestant skepticism, which I totally understand, having grown up and always been Protestant, towards the tradition of the saints, which is if we cut ourselves off from the saint tradition, we cut ourselves off from all of the women who were these amazing models for Christianity, who died for their faith, who did these incredible things, but were sometimes worried or nervous about talking about them. Because it might be misunderstood or misapplied. And so I think that is definitely part of it. And I also kind of wonder if it's just the way that we learn. We tend to focus on writing, and a lot of women just couldn't, for all sorts of reasons, write their own stories. And so either men were telling women's stories or kind of lost in the margins that way. And so we need to learn to see them, I think, in different spaces and learn to look maybe in ways that we're not used to be able to recognize the incredible presence they've had through our whole history.
I love it.
That's Lanta Davis. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Becoming by Beholding. You can also check out her story in this month's Christianity Today called The Witness of Women is Written on the Walls. Lanta, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
Truly, the pleasure is ours. We'll take a quick break, a reset. It's our daily feature.
Does this make sense?
Does this make sense? That's next on The Ride Home.
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Saran wrap. Plastic wrap. Whatever you want to call it. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
Cling wrap. Does that make sense?
It's a miracle. It makes perfect sense.
Okay.
I love it so much. I do. I just...
Mm-hmm. Really?
It's just... It's amazing. Until it gets all bangled up in your fist and you're trying to figure it out. But it makes sense. I mean, seriously, it does keep things fresh, right? I love it.
It's such a pain.
No, no.
Yeah. What do you mean, no, no?
No.
You try to pull it out. First of all, if it gets stuck on the roll, heaven help you.
Well, there's okay. That problem. Right.
And then you try to get it off the roll, and you try to get it on, like, the cutter part,
right.
Except that you now have cut yourself while you're trying to get the saran wrap on there.
Then
you pull it out, and it overlaps, and then you have to throw that away and start over. Mm. Come on.
We're just spoiled.
No, we're not spoiled. No, I'm a practical person.
So you're saying it doesn't?
I'm just saying it's so much more work than it should be, so it doesn't make sense.
Well, whenever it comes time to use it, I always eye it with a little bit of trepidation, knowing the aforementioned problems are there. So you have to be very careful and slow and methodical about the use of it. But in its basic form... Excellent. Truly, a little miracle.
No, it's not. It's,
it makes sense to me.
A little miracle.
It is.
I mean, that's a stretch. It's so annoying.
You have a low bar for miracles.
I mean, I use it only because I have to, because I just hate it that much.
Okay.
So I'd actually come down.
It
no,
doesn't.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, for me, it does. It's a little miracle. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Alexa, Siri, all those other little things. Alexa... eavesdropping on my life. Does that make... Do you want that thing? Does that make sense to you?
I like Siri.
Oh, come on.
But I don't like Alexa.
I don't like either of them.
Okay. They're I don't like Alexa.
Poking
but
around.
But I feel like I need some help in my life, John.
But how about when Siri...
What, like, so I say,
halfway.
Siri, call John. Like, thank you that someone's going to help me out by calling you.
It'll call
I don't
John
put...
McNoodle. It'll get it
that,
wrong.
That does happen sometimes.
Of course it does.
Right.
It's always the wrong thing. And then you get mad. I'm like getting mad
at Siri. Do you want
us
to call John Davidson?
No.
No, actually I don't.
Okay.
I haven't thought about him in 30 years.
Exactly. Then I've got to reset and then I get... I'm expending emotional capital on this AI thing.
I thought you had decided you were pro Alexa.
No, I'm not.
You're
no,
not.
I
so
know.
Alexa,
I have no Alexa. I have none of that.
Oh, Alexa's
thing.
Gone.
Nothing.
And you have no relationship with Siri. You talk
no,
to Siri.
I have to talk to Siri.
Why? You don't
occasionally.
Have to.
Well, yeah, once in a while you
I
do.
I think it makes sense.
It does,
I like
makes
Siri.
No sense.
Alexa's creepy.
It'd make the best sense if I'd say, Siri, use Saran Wrap. And then Siri, we go, okay, here's how this works.
Hey, Siri, call John.
Yeah. See? Doesn't even work. Waste.
Doesn't even work.
Since the pandemic, like all things, tipping has become a thing. Like a big deal. I'm going to Panera, and there's a little tip 15%,
right.
20%.
I was at Staples the other day.
They wanted to tip? You wanted to tip at Staples? So it's a thing now, right?
Right.
Now, take that, the confusion here in the United States, and go travel overseas. What does tipping look like around the world? Say you're going to travel.
Yeah, it's very confusing.
It is confusing, right?
I remember talking to people before I went to Europe the first time, the only time I've been to Europe. And I was like, you have to help me. Like, I don't know how to approach this. And when I was on my way to Germany, I was talking to a woman who said, look, I used to live in Germany. You don't tip.
You don't tip at all in Germany.
And
really?
I was like, what? Well, when I got to Germany,
they were tipping.
People were tipping. So mm-hmm. I don't know what she was talking about.
So you tipped.
Well, but it's not a 20% thing. It is less. But I was tipping 20% because I thought, well, first of all, I can't speak the language.
Right.
They're working pretty hard to have me as a guest in the restaurant. And so I just figured I'm tipping 20%.
Just throwing cash all over the place.
I kind of was.
Comes the Emmons party.
It's pretty cheap.
Right. Oh, so tipping is weird, right?
There's yeah, no it's hard definitive. To know what to do.
Okay, so I see an article in what's this called? It's called Reader's Digest.
Oh, yeah. Oh, what is that thing called?
When's the last time you read Reader's Digest?
I don't know. I think I was probably in third grade.
Well, newsflash, Reader's Digest on the ride home. It's the large type edition. Your grandma ever have that? Like the large type edition of any magazine?
Oh, yeah. What about,
love that.
Is this going to be condensed?
Oh, well, because Reader's Digest is all condensed.
Remember the Reader's Digest condensed books, the hardbacks?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Oh, The Grapes of Wrath, like 32 pages. What are you kidding me?
I feel like you're missing out.
The Iliad.
That's some big parts of the story.
Yeah, people had like volumes.
Yes. Of the condensed books. That's just a little lazy.
That's cheating.
Just be like, come on.
I mean, that was someone's job.
It was.
Right? Every day they woke up and were like, okay, we're going to condense Sense and Sensibility.
Right. I mean, it turned into a magazine.
Anyway, we are reading from Reader's Digest today on the ride home. So Reader's Digest says, of course, the tipping is strange, like what you're talking about. Leave tips and cash in the local currency. That makes sense. Check your bill first to see if a gratuity or tip has already been added.
Mm-hmm.
So is it already built in? Okay. Tipping culture in Europe is more relaxed than in the United mm-hmm. States. So there's a lot less pressure to know all the rules, right? When calculating tips, keep in mind that European service staff and restaurant workers in particular may be less solicitous than people in the West, right? So you're like here, people, your waiter's checking in. Everything okay? Here in Italy or in Europe, you've got to like raise your hand. Excuse me.
Okay.
And they're a little more in tune. So if you go to, you think, oh, I'm going to tip less because they weren't paying attention to me, right?
Oh, right. But that's just how it is.
Right. That's the culture.
Got it.
Right. Okay. European hotels, they're saying not that big of a deal. Tip your porter a few dollars,
yeah.
But everybody else, you know, you're staying at a hostel, no tipping
right,
at a hostel.
No tipping.
Federal laws in Switzerland mandate that all service charges be included in published prices. So in Switzerland, don't worry about the tip. European restaurants, 15%. You are not that far away,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
A good thing to do. But a lot of them, they make more money hourly.
Right, than people do here.
Right.
Right. So tipping isn't as big of a deal.
So overall, Reader's Digest is saying, ask a friend.
Yeah, right. Except not this lady that I talked to before I went to Germany, because people were tipping. It is weird, though, because when you're when you're in another country, and hopefully this is your attitude, is that you want to be a good guest. You know, I don't want to go in.
Be the ugly American.
Exactly. Go in, you know, talk loud and act like you own the place. You know, I can't stand that. I read a great book. I can see the cover and I can't think of what the author is.
It's condensed on Reader's Digest.
No, it's actually not condensed. Darn it. Terry Glaspie.
Oh,
is his name.
Terry
you know
Glaspie.
Terry.
Yeah,
he's
I did.
Been on
yeah,
our show.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it was another book he wrote that is not the one that we talked to him about. Anyway.
Which Terry, this was the Reader's Digest version.
Terry was writing about art and writing about travel.
Yes.
And he said how important it is to be a traveler instead of a tourist.
Mm. There's a big distinction there.
Yeah. And a tourist is trying to, you know, make sure if you go to the Louvre, you have to run and make sure you see the Mona Lisa and you see this, you know, you have to check all these things off of your list. But a traveler just kind of shows up with an open heart, an open mind, and just, you know, experiences it.
You find yourself on a rooftop in Portugal.
And I think you do end up being a more gracious visitor if you look at it that way, rather than going into somebody's country or town or whatever, just trying to get all the things that you can out of it. Just kind of see what it's like.
Well, I've been thinking about Europe frequently. A good family member of ours is headed to Paris for the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to live there. I mean, he should be leaving soon. He'll stay there because his company's assigning him to stay at the Olympics. So can you imagine what Europe will be like this summer?
I cannot.
Right? It's going to be super, super crowded.
Yeah.
But wouldn't love to be there.
Yes. I have family members that are going to the Olympics too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm very jealous.
Me too.
I would love to do that. Do you know that at the Olympics this time, it's the first time that an opening ceremony won't happen in a stadium in the modern era?
Where will it be?
It's going to be along the Seine.
Really?
So the athletes are going to come down the Seine
on
in boats.
What?
And you... I'm not exactly sure what the measurement is, but the people who are closest to the river's edge, those are going to be paid assigned seats like you would find in a stadium. But then there's just going to be open seating from a certain point back.
How long will the route be, I wonder?
It's long. It's like 9 miles or something.
Sure.
So that's a lot of people. So I love that idea.
What's security going to be like? Can you imagine what?
That's all
I
can think of. How do you control that?
I don't see how you can.
I mean, I just think it's incredible. The book I just finished called Paris, the Novel by William Rutherford talks about the Olympics in Paris in...
1900s?
No, it was the 1860 maybe. And just it was fascinating knowing that the Olympics are coming up in Paris this year and just hearing how different it was and how they were, you know, how they were thinking through, you know, how, like what they didn't even know what the events were.
Really?
Yeah, because.
Yeah, there's no mass communication.
Right. There's no mass communication. And so they're like, you know what? They're going to throw what?
Interesting.
Like, well, come with me. You can see it's called a discus.
And so it wasn't like the buzz that all this is now.
It was a buzz, but only for people who were in a higher economic class.
Mm-hmm.
Like for the people who were the bourgeois.
Mm-hmm.
They were going.
Bougie.
You know what I mean? They were the people who knew the art scene. They were the people that knew the music scene. And they were the people that were going to take advantage of the Olympics. But a lot of people didn't even know what was happening.
Right. And how did they tip?
It's a good question. Okay. Let me bring this up while you're talking about tipping. I thought of this other article I saw today.
Okay.
Dinner parties. When you were little, did your parents have them?
Yes.
Okay.
When we were kids, they would have friends over and have dinner parties. And then I remember getting my own place and having my own dinner parties and thought, I'm an adult now.
Yes. Right.
Which was so much fun.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that's like a marker, right? You've arrived into inviting friends over. You assemble a diverse guest list, this friend and this friend. And then there's a menu, a meal. You're in charge of it. I mean, to me, that's like a high watermark.
It is, because there's a lot that goes into that.
Heck yeah, there is.
There's a lot of preparation. There's a lot of organization.
Yep.
There's a lot of that. Well, it seems like younger generations are getting excited about dinner parties again.
Good.
So maybe this is a post-COVID thing. I'm reading this from Axios.com. But entertaining at home is a lot easier because going out for dinner is very expensive right now.
But it's so much more relaxed at home.
Well, it can be more relaxed at home, but if you're throwing the dinner party, it's not necessarily relaxed for you, depending on how organized you
are. There's a lot there.
Okay. So they're saying that a lot of startups are calling themselves dinner party helpers.
What do you mean, like a caterer?
Yeah. But not only a caterer. So somebody who could make the food, which, look, if you're having a caterer do your food, then how hard is your dinner party?
Exactly.
But anyway, whatever. But people who have a lot of disposable income, they're going to hire a caterer. What about somebody who's going to make a Spotify playlist for your dinner party?
Mm-hmm.
You can find that.
Sure.
Or menu ideas.
Yeah.
These are foods that go together.
Right.
These are foods that are relatively easy to prepare. Or a lot of the difficulty in cooking, to be honest with you, is just realizing the kinds of things you can't cook at the same time because you don't have enough oven space.
And or the timeliness
exactly.
of what's arriving
exactly,
when.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. So a lot of those, there are a lot of online websites that help you to understand that, which I think is really cool. Anyway, what they're saying is you're not going to be Martha Stewart the first time you host, and that's okay. That's why you come to us. So you could get a curated dinner party guide from Hannah Flores and her brother, Raymond. And they kind of help you, apparently, to not focus on the particulars and get bogged down, but look at the bigger picture and say, look, you're with people that you really care about or people you want to get to know. And so let us handle some of the details so that you can be yourself.
Okay, I get that.
I kind of like it.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is, right, if you're inviting people to your house, they feel special because all of a sudden they're put
in
the guest mode, right? They get an invitation. So I think short of food poisoning, it's going to be pretty fun, right? It should be.
And it should be fun in the moment. But you know that if we're talking about this age of person, and even all of us now, a lot of the things they're doing at a dinner party are so that you can see it on Instagram.
Oh.
So their tablescape is a big deal, right? Or they have different themed experiences or whatever.
Sure.
Is a big thing. But searches for dinner parties on Google has increased 148% from this time last year.
I love it so much.
So people are doing it.
Yeah, yeah. We had a dinner party once where our dog jumped on the table. Thankfully, it was towards the end of the evening. People were feeding the dog, and he got excited and leapt up.
This was at your parents' house?
My house.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's something.
Yeah.
Lexi, dinner parties part of your life when you were growing up or part of your life now?
A dinner party?
Not necessarily a dinner party, but my family did host a lot of parties at like our house, like for holidays and stuff. So
company coming over.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets excited when company comes over.
Yeah, it's a big celebration in a weird way.
I love that. Okay, so the last dinner party I had was a salute to my Polish heritage. We had the pierogi dinner party.
Boy, we sure did. And you know, the problem was, you've made such excellent food, but
you can't eat it all.
No, I was full, like, quickly.
Well, when you have a pierogi dinner party, you fill up kind of fast.
Right. I think, did I have, like, maybe 8 or 9 pierogis?
Right.
And then was yearning for more.
That's a pretty good haul.
I was hoping for 20.
Sorry.
So next week is Holy Week, which means this Sunday is Palm Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's probably true. Like, do you think all Christian denominations at worship this week will hand out palms?
I think so.
Pretty common.
I think so.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I love it.
Me too.
I think it's a weird day to me because it's a day of great celebration, but also great, not just sadness, because I know it's coming in the
foreboding.
Week.
Foreboding.
But it's also like it's such a sad thing to know that the people were shouting Hosanna and then a couple days later, this is what happened.
Yeah. It just shows how fickle we are.
Fickle. That's
right?
What it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the fickle holiday.
Yeah. I remember being a kid and being, I don't know how this happened, like in the back of the church before they handed out the palm and seeing like, you know, big thick layers of it. And like being amazed by it, how beautiful it was. The green mixed with sort of like the silky feel of it.
Yep.
And then you peel them off.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts you right in the perspective. You
it
think,
does.
I would be there. I'm there waving my palm at Jesus.
Right. Hosanna.
And then you take it home. Okay. Do you
And you turn it into a cross?
No. I generally put it behind a frame.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course,
that's
over the course
idea.
Of the year,
you can look at it.
It dries out. It just, you know, it's there. But you do look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever, you know, and then next Sunday, this coming Sunday, I mean, you know, you take off the old palm and put
a new
one
on.
Place.
Yeah.
Do you make a cross? You do?
No, I don't know how to do that.
I
always liked when people did it, though. Okay, let me ask you this. You said Holy Week at the beginning of our segment.
Yeah.
Lex, when you were growing up, would you call next week Holy Week?
Yes, I would.
Okay. And you grew up in what denomination?
Catholic.
Okay. So I grew up Protestant.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the term Holy Week is Catholic?
No.
Not necessarily, no.
No.
Okay.
I think it's if you come from a liturgical background,
Okay.
Right?
Like Anglican or Orthodox or
right,
something
yeah.
like that.
Then I think it's just baked into...
Okay, listen, because I had a friend the other day. We were just talking about it. I said something about Holy Week, and she was like, wait a minute. What are you saying? And I said, Holy Week. And she's like, that's Catholic.
What?
Does that surprise you?
Yeah, it does.
In this day and age, it surprises
me. Yeah, she's like, that's Catholic. And I was like, do you think? And she was like, well, she's non-denom. Hmm. And she was like, I have never... She said, I heard that term, like, one of my teachers in elementary school was Catholic and said that.
Really? I mean, I consider Holy Week high week of the church.
Right. And I would call it Holy Week. I grew up Presbyterian. I would still call it that. But I think there's a segment of people, there's probably a segment of our listening base.
Probably so.
Who thinks that...
It's a Catholic thing. Or an Anglican thing, an Episcopal. I mean, if you follow along biblically, almost something earth-shaking happens every
yes,
day.
Yes, of course. Now, Lex, you go to a Presbyterian church.
Yes, I do.
Would you... Holy Week? Is that...
I mean, that's what we've been calling it.
Yeah, okay.
Monday, Thursday service.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Of course, Good Friday service.
Right.
Listen, I mean, as a Catholic schoolboy, we did Stations of the Cross till it was coming out of our ears. And seriously, I remember thinking, oh, please, you know, Jesus, get up, please.
Yeah.
I mean, it just went on forever as a kid. Like, I was like 8, thinking, this is going to go. But now, of course, I love it.
Right.
It's seeped into your life.
Yeah, right.
The beauty of it, the majesty, the horror of it all that story that we need to engage next week deeply in Holy Week.
I think so, too.
And Christ's slow procession to the cross.
Yeah,
and then, of course,
I think so too.
The exaltation of Christmas.
There's
Easter
no
morning.
Celebration on Easter morning without the suffering that comes before it, right?
The Ride Home with John and Kathy. A production of Salem Media Group.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.